The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. I'm Jana Murray from Hockley, Texas. I listen every morning while on my elliptical. My husband Tim and I enjoy reading World Magazine. Our children point to locations on a globe while watching World Watch. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. President Biden plans to wipe out certain student loan debt, but he's getting pushback from within his own party.
Many individuals made a conscious decision not to attend college to avoid debt. So forgiveness proposals at any amount would foist someone else's debt onto them.
Also, it's been 3 years since Nigerian Christian Leah Sharibu was kidnapped by terrorists. We'll hear the latest on that. Plus, encouragement for husbands this weekend.
Choose to focus on the good and the beautiful and the strong in your wife.
And if your Valentine is a bit frayed, commentator Kim Henderson has some advice for wives.
It's Thursday, February 11th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Megan Basham.
Time now for news with Kent Covington.
Lawmakers will reconvene at noon today for day three of former President Trump's Senate impeachment trial. On Wednesday, impeachment managers wrapped up opening arguments detailing months of tweets and remarks by the former president that they say fueled the January 6th Capitol siege. Congresswoman Madeleine Dean told senators,
Donald Trump told his supporters they are stealing the election. They took away your vote. It's rigged. That was not true.
And Congressman Jamie Raskin argued,
in the days leading up to the attack, you'll learn that there were countless social media posts, news stories, and most importantly, credible reports from the FBI and Capitol Police that the thousands gathering for the President's Save America March were violent, organized with weapons, and were targeting the Capitol.
Impeachment managers charged that Trump was no innocent bystander, but was instead the, quote, incitor-in-chief. But Trump's defense lawyers maintained that the president neither called for nor expected violence. And many Senate Republicans say they've seen nothing that proves the former president's guilt. Senator Kevin Cramer told Fox News on Wednesday,
I think that the line between, you know, criminal liability and, you know, firing up a crowd is, you know, it's a pretty tough, I think, cause and effect to make for an insurrection.
The trial will continue at least through tomorrow afternoon. After closing arguments, senators will have a total of 4 hours to question both sides. Democrats muscled past Republicans this week to advance two big components of President Biden's COVID-19 relief plan. Democrats on the Education and Labor panel approved a measure that would send $130 billion in additional relief to schools and another measure that would increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki touted a report from the Congressional Budget Office suggesting the wage hike would help many at the bottom of the pay scale.
They've also concluded that 27 million American workers millions of low wage workers, I should say, 27 million American workers would help get them out of poverty.
But GOP Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa said Democrats are not painting the complete picture.
What they are forgetting, these progressive liberals, is the folks in middle America where our cost of living is much lower. Raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour will put 1.4 million Americans out of work.
Democrats hope to rush the bill to Biden for his signature by mid-March using a special budget-related process called reconciliation that would allow them to cut Republicans out of the process. House Republicans attempted dozens of changes to the legislation. One proposed amendment would have exempted small businesses or certain rural areas from a minimum wage hike, but that amendment fell short. It's still unclear, though, if Democrats will be able to raise the minimum wage using budget reconciliation. Federal authorities are investigating a massive counterfeit N95 mask operation after someone sold fake 3M masks to hospitals and government agencies. World's Kristen Flavin reports.
N95 masks are considered the gold standard for protection against the coronavirus, but foreign-made fakes are becoming increasingly tough to spot, and that is raising worries over the safety of healthcare workers. Homeland Security investigator Steve Francis said DHS is seeing a lot of fraud and other illegal activity as crooks cash in on the pandemic. Investigators say they've also seen an increase in phony websites purporting to sell vaccines, as well as fake medicine and personal protective equipment. Federal authorities have already executed more than 1,200 raids, seizing more than 10 million counterfeit 3M masks alone. And 3M, based in Maplewood, Minnesota, has filed more than a dozen lawsuits over reports of fraud, counterfeiting, and price gouging. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
14 state attorneys general are calling on President Biden to reverse course on the Keystone XL pipeline. Biden has signed an executive order seeking to stop construction on the project. In a joint letter to the president, the attorneys stated, quote, "Your decision will result in devastating damage to many of our states and local communities." Texas Land Commissioner George P. Bush said a growing number of lawmakers, including some Democrats, are asking Biden to rethink the order. But he said they are not banking on it.
For us, an industry that employs over 400,000 Texans and on average pays over $120,000. This is a lifeblood of our economy. So we're going to leverage every legal remedy available to the state.
The new chairman of the Senate Energy Committee is one of those Democrats asking President Biden to reconsider. Senator Joe Manchin said Keystone XL and other pipelines, quote, "continue to be the safest mode to transport our oil and natural gas resources, and they support thousands of high-paying American union jobs." President Biden sided with environmental groups that say the pipeline poses too great a risk. The 1,700-mile pipeline was planned to carry roughly 800,000 barrels of oil each day from Alberta to the Texas Gulf Coast. Speaking at the White House on Wednesday, President Biden said the United States is taking action against the military leaders behind the coup in Myanmar. He said, first, the U.S. government will prevent the generals from improperly accessing the $1 billion in Myanmar government funds held in the United States.
And today, I've approved a new executive order enabling us to immediately sanction the military leaders who directed the coup, their business interests, as well as close family members.
The president again called on those generals to relinquish power and release the political leaders it is now holding captive. Meantime, in Myanmar, large crowds demonstrated against the military takeover again on Wednesday, defying a ban on protests. Tens of thousands of protesters packed the streets in the country's largest cities. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, the president's push to erase student loan debt, plus Kim Henderson on a twofold approach to lifelong love. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Thursday, the 11th of February, 2021. You're listening to The World and Everything in It, and we're so glad you are. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Megan Basham. First up, student debt. Last year, in response to the pandemic and the resulting economic downturn, the government froze federal student loans. Borrowers weren't required to make payments, and interest accumulation stopped.
This year, President Joe Biden extended the freeze through September, and he wants Congress to forgive $10,000 of federal debt per student. But some Democrats are pushing for more drastic action. World's Esther Eaton reports.
Hope Campbell graduated from Union University in May 2020 with a degree in political science and about $9,000 in debt. Thanks to the freeze, she hasn't had to make monthly payments yet.
Which was nice because that's really the only COVID relief that I've felt because my parents still claim me as a dependent. And so I haven't gotten any stimulus money. So that has been a good plus.
Campbell is one of about 43 million people in the United States with student loan debt. Altogether, they owe about $1.5 trillion. By paying $100 here and there, Campbell has whittled her debt down to about $7,000. Prominent Democrats want President Biden to wipe out the rest of Campbell's debt with a stroke of his pen. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York unveiled the proposal last week.
We are here today to introduce our proposal to cancel $50,000 in student debt. And take a huge burden off so many people in America.
Schumer, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and others are pushing Biden to do that by executive order. So far, Biden has resisted, preferring to let Congress do the canceling. His press secretary, Jen Psaki, reiterated his stance at a briefing last week.
The president has and continues to support canceling $10,000 of federal student loan debt per person as a response to the COVID crisis. He's calling on Congress to draft the proposal, and if it is passed and sent to his desk, he will look forward to signing it.
Biden's smaller forgiveness package is intended to target borrowers who never graduated college. Without a degree, they don't reap the reward of higher earnings and so struggle to pay off even small amounts of debt. But critics say canceling debts places an unfair burden on taxpayers, especially those who didn't attend college or who worked to cover costs as they went. Lindsay Burke, director of education policy at the Heritage Foundation, explained the problem to Sinclair Broadcast Group last week.
Many individuals made a conscious decision not to attend college to avoid debt. So forgiveness proposals at any amount would foist someone else's debt onto them.
Biden's $10,000 forgiveness proposal will cost about $370 billion, according to higher education researcher Preston Cooper. And Senator Warren estimated forgiving $50,000 per borrower would cost almost twice that. And canceling current debts won't prevent future students from racking up new debt loads. To help with that problem, the president has proposed eliminating community college tuition for low-income students. But that wouldn't make much of a dent in future loans. Analysts at the American Enterprise Institute estimate it would only take 14 years for federal student loans to climb back to today's level. Campbell used academic scholarships, a job as a residential assistant, and help from her parents to reduce her undergraduate debt. But now she's considering taking out more loans to pay for a master's degree in social work.
I have definitely looked at how much tuition costs. I'm waiting on my financial aid package, which apparently will show up in March. I'm a little nervous about that, of how much it's going to add.
Only a quarter of student borrowers have graduate degrees, but a Brookings Institution analysis last year found that they account for half of all U.S. student debt. Campbell won't have to worry about her current loans until later this year. And until she finds out whether Congress will write them off, she doesn't plan to make any regular payments. Reporting for World, I'm Esther Eaton.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, persecution. Tomorrow marks the third anniversary of a mass kidnapping in Nigeria that sparked international outrage. On February 12, 2018, Boko Haram fighters attacked a school in Dapchi in northeast Nigeria. They took more than 100 girls hostage. A month later, only one remained in captivity, 15-year-old Leah Sharibu.
Most of the girls kidnapped were Muslim, but Leah Sharibu is Christian. Her captors demanded she renounce her faith to gain her freedom, but she refused. 3 years later, she still hasn't come home. Joining us now to talk about Leah's case is Onize Ohikere. She's World's Africa reporter based in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning, Onize.
Good morning, Mary.
About 6 months after Leah's abduction, Boko Haram released an audio recording of her asking Nigeria's president to negotiate for her release. Now, is that the last time her family heard from her? And have they had any confirmation that she's still alive?
So unfortunately, there hasn't been any recent proof of life that we've seen or heard, although there have been a few in the past. So back in August of 2018, that was just months after Leah was abducted, she appeared in the only video recording we've seen so far and pleaded for the government to intervene in her case and just to continue to protect her parents and her younger brother. And then in January last year, a released hostage who was also held by the same extremist group said she came across Alice Ngada, who was a Christian aid worker abducted about a month after Leah. And so at the time, Alice confirmed that Leah was alive and doing well. But yeah, we haven't heard anything recently.
So disappointing. In 2019, Leah's mother came to Washington, D.C. to plead with U.S. lawmakers to intervene in her daughter's case. The family said then that they had not heard from the Nigerian government in months. Onize, have government officials spoken at all about the case since then?
So the government has insisted that it would not relent in its effort to bring Leah back home. So in February last year, the government reported that insurgents actually rejected a ransom to free Leah, but that's still unconfirmed. And I think that represents the difficulty that her family is facing. You know, Leah's parents, as you said, reported that they have been in the dark over the case. Just last month, her father, Nathan, told the BBC in an interview that he has basically left everything to God, because at the time there were rumors circulating that Leah had given birth to a child for one of the insurgents. And he said, you know, he's been unable to verify the report since government officials have still not spoken to the family.
Right. Leah's kidnapping wasn't the first involving a large number of schoolgirls. Boko Haram kidnapped hundreds of girls from a school in Chibok 4 years before that. And that got a lot of attention all around the world. Many of those girls are still being held. Are those cases something that still gets attention in Nigeria? Is Leah's plight still well known there?
Yeah. I think, you know, there's still some attention to it because there's still that frustration and exhaustion really over how long this case has lasted. So actually, the recent capture of the Kankara schoolboys, they were abducted and released in December. It drew a lot of questions and anger over the delay in Leah's case and also, you know, the remaining Chibok girls who are still not accounted for. And we've seen that leaders of the Christian Association of Nigeria, they actually reminded the government that it bears that moral burden to release the girls. There are also other groups that are actively pushing awareness, you know, so people still remember that Leah is not yet free. The Leah Foundation, for example, which started just after her abduction, they're basically running a 7-day prayer campaign that actually ends tomorrow. And some of the intentions they've brought up are, you know, praying for her release, but also praying for other victims of persecution.
Violence against Christians has continued to rise in parts of Nigeria, I understand. Do these ongoing attacks get a lot of attention there? And is it something that the Christian community talks about?
Yeah, so the attacks have persisted for a long time in the Northeast, but now, you know, we're actually hearing of even more attacks against Christians and communities in the Northwest, Central Nigeria, too. And so there's this actually a growing sense of awareness that the insecurity is worsening. I mean, just over Christmas break, there were multiple attacks on churches and communities in the Northeast and in the central part of Nigeria. And just last month, you know, late in January, a Catholic priest was abducted and then killed in Minna, which is a city in central Nigeria. So churches are hearing these stories, you know, sharing these stories and praying for the affected communities. But another thing is, you know, it has also triggered this sense of helplessness in the way people perceive the government, because they've more or less, you know, lost confidence in the government's ability to ensure their safety. And, you know, the Christian Association of Nigeria, again this month, asked authorities to even start considering help from other countries like the United States and Israel to fight insurgency and abductions, because they've gotten to the point where they believe that the government cannot handle this, you know, on its own.
Onize Ohikere is World Africa reporter. She's based in Abuja, Nigeria. You can read her reports on WNG.org and hear her international news roundup on World Tour right here every Wednesday. Thanks so much, Onize.
You're welcome, Mary.
Some real estate news in case you're looking for a place in London town. The asking price is $1.3 million. Now, that's a lot of money for sure, but relative to other real estate in London, it's sort of a bargain. The average home there goes for more than 700 grand. And this thing, it's more like a small skyscraper, 5 stories high, luxurious touches galore, and in a desirable district. Listing agent David Myers had this to say about the property.
The house is simply so special because of how unique it is. There's no houses in London there are houses in London that are 5 stories high, but not have such a unique space, such individuality.
Ah, but there's a catch.
There's always a catch, right?
Right. Well, what makes the home unique is it's only 6 feet wide. It's known as the skinniest house in London, and it's only around 1,000 square feet. The structure, built over 100 years ago, originally served as a Victorian hat shop with storage and living space above.
So you're saying history, hats, maybe an incentive to keep your weight in check. I could use all that.
So could I. It's the world and everything in it. Today is Thursday, February 11th. We're so glad you've turned to World Radio to start your day. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Megan Basham. Valentine's Day is this weekend, so hopefully that's not news to you.
Hopefully not.
Especially looking at you, Mr. Basham. Well, over the next few minutes, we have some encouragement for both husbands and wives on ways to cultivate loving relationships.
Well, let's start with the husbands, shall we? World's Paul Butler recently spoke with a marriage counselor about some helpful ideas for men. Good advice, not only for this weekend, it's good for the rest of the year, too.
I've never found a woman who did not want to be dated by her husband.
As an elder, missionary, and marriage counselor, Todd Adams spends a lot of time mentoring men, particularly husbands. He's been at it for a quarter of a century.
It actually can be very enjoyable to find ways to bless your wife, and you need to study her. We need to study our wives and understand what it is that really makes them shine and glow.
When Valentine's Day rolls around each year, many men struggle to know exactly what gift will best communicate love to their wives. Perhaps that insecurity stems from poor selections in the past. And while there are dozens of helpful online gift guides this time of year, every woman's different. So what's a man to do? In his many years of counseling, Todd Adams has discovered a gift that never fails.
I believe one of the greatest gifts that we can give to our wives is to celebrate them in the way we think about them and the way we pray for them. Because as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And we know from Scripture that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So we start with cherishing our wives in our thoughts.
Now, over the next 48 hours, many husbands will agonize over Valentine card selections. What's the best approach? Humorous, romantic, sarcastic? It's difficult to find the perfect card, so Todd Adams has a practical suggestion. Skip the card this year and instead write a love letter.
I think a physical letter is a wonderful thing. And people today, when they get a letter, are deeply blessed because it's not something that's done much anymore. So to write a physical letter to your wife is a tremendous blessing. It's a statement of value of her.
And now that sounds good, but many of us struggle to know what to write.
When they are pouring themselves out, which our wives do in their role in the home as wife and mother, ways that they're investing their energy, their attention, their focus, their love, so many selfless acts. And I think they need to hear from us that we're noticing those things.
A good starting point is a heartfelt compliment.
Things that are character things and behavior things, things that represent her values and her uniqueness as a person. These are what I like about you. And just, you know, you could start a sentence with that. Some of the things that I enjoy or I appreciate or I like about you, and just start writing. Just let your heart flow.
Todd Adams has been married for 34 years. He hasn't always gotten it right, but he learned early on how important it is to not just do these things on Valentine's Day. Your wife's expecting kindness and affection this weekend, but what about March 7th, or April 17th, or November 3rd?
It is important. Events like Valentine's Day, birthdays, anniversaries, those are important. But what almost has, with some women, more impact is when they're just a random Saturday morning or something, and you leave a letter of love on her pillow, or she's being...
Adams acknowledges that Valentine's Day can be a struggle for some husbands, as it's a reminder that their marriage isn't exactly what they want it to be.
There are men that are so discouraged and feel so beaten down or depressed about the state of their marriage, because I hear the same thing from enough men that I realized that there are times when a whole segment of men feel like it's kind of hopeless.
But it's not hopeless. Adams has seen over and over again how many times God works through a man fighting for his marriage.
I want to take us to Philippians 4:8. Whatever is beautiful, whatever is true, whatever is virtuous, whatever is good report, etc. Choose to focus on the good and the beautiful and the strong in your wife. And if you feel like that's like 10% of what you experience and the 90% is hard, well, focus on the 10% and pour yourself into that. And it takes discipline of thought. It takes some real going to the Lord, seeking for the Spirit to transform the inner person. Really, the first place to go is to the Lord in prayer and ask Him to stir love, affection, like even, appreciation, all of that, friendship, companionship, stir that in your heart. That is the first place to start.
So this weekend, buy that gift, write that letter, have a nice dinner, but make it truly special with a fresh start.
I mean, it's a project to practice all around the year. By project, I mean, you know, a focus on something to make a priority. And I find that men who dig into that find it's actually very enjoyable to ratchet up the romance in their marriages by kind of thinking outside the box and being attentive apart from just the almost dutiful expressions of, you know, Valentine's Day and so forth.
Love letters straight.
Reporting for World, I'm Paul Butler.
From your heart.
Later in the program, Kim Henderson has some thoughts for wives this Valentine's weekend.
Additional support comes from The Masters University, a Christian liberal arts university in Southern California that has stood firm for 94 years on Christ and Scripture. More at masters.edu. And from Crossing Cultures International, an organization that equips and trains indigenous pastors and church leaders in more than 33 countries. More at cciequip.org.
Coming up next, a preview of Listening In. This week, host Warren Smith talks with author and speaker Brett McCracken. He's an elder in his church and is also a senior editor at the Gospel Coalition.
McCracken remembered as a kid learning about the food pyramid in health class and how the daily elements of a healthy physical diet ought to include a variety of good foods, fruits, vegetables, grains, and dairy. That inspired him to develop a similar idea for good spiritual health. Let's listen in.
I thought about like the food pyramid from my childhood and how that was such a helpful rubric, kind of visual aid for guiding us to healthy sources of food, food groups, for a diet that would make us physically healthy. And so I thought, what if I played off of that to create like a wisdom pyramid that functioned in the same way by pointing people to sources, in this case, sources of information or knowledge that are conducive to a healthy spiritual life. So I basically scratched it out on a napkin and kind of how I would create a wisdom pyramid if I were to do that. And I had a designer friend of mine, graphic designer, make it look nice. People really responded to it and kind of went viral on social media, ironically, given that social media is the fats, oils, and sweets category of the wisdom pyramid. But yeah,
right. Yeah.
So that's where it started.
Let's look a little bit at the unhealthy diet that has gotten us to the place that we are. You say basically that today we eat too much, we eat too fast, and we eat only what tastes good to us. You call that information gluttony. Can you say a little bit more about this idea of information gluttony and how eating too much, too fast, and only what we like is a problem?
Yeah, I was helped with just thinking through this parallel to eating food and our physical health and different ways that bad eating habits make us sick. And I think there's actually some pretty close parallels to bad habits of information intake that also make us sick in similar ways to eating habits. So the gluttony piece is, you know, obviously when you eat too much food, when you're a glutton with food, you're going to get sick. It's going to be bad for your health. And the same is true with information. And we live in an age of just an insane amount of information. It's really mind-boggling how much information is at our fingertips, literally. You pull out your smartphone and you have access to the entire accumulated knowledge of human civilization, basically. And while that may seem like it would be helpful for our wisdom, I don't think that it actually has been. And I think most of us would probably say that as there has been more and more information at our fingertips, we've actually, as a society, by and large, become less wise. And why is that?
To hear Brett McCracken's answer to that question and their complete conversation, look for Listening In with Warren Smith this weekend, wherever you get your podcasts.
On a day like today, we pass the time away, writing love letters in the sand.
Today is Thursday, February 11th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Commentator Kim Henderson now with some advice for wives from a love story that stood the test of time.
My friend Tony wondered if that man of hers even took the time to read them, the notes she tucked in his shirt pocket every ironing day. Back then, as she sprayed the starch and swiped the sleeves, she'd write a little love line and put it in there where he'd find it when he wore those shirts. And Tony prayed, too, as she pressed the pinpoint cotton collars and the curled-up hems. Yes, she'd pray for that man of hers who had the mayor's number on speed dial but couldn't make it to their kids' soccer games or church or home so very much. And she wondered, without saying a word, about his not saying a word about those little gestures of love, the ones that spanned a course of years. In time, the children grew, along with his business, and the family address changed to a fancy subdivision where the pool guy made regular stops. Shirts went to the cleaners, leaving Tony more time to pray. But what about those love lines she had penned? Well, they ended up as lifelines. Those notes and 100 other things Tony did without expecting any sure return. Her beloved told her as much when he finally showed her the drawer where he had kept them, every last one of them, for all those years. So when the couple and their teenagers eventually lost the house with the pool and their sure footing and pretty much everything else they had, they held on tight to each other and made it through. Then somehow Tony's man, the one who had drawn up business plans and flown to New York every Monday, ended up working hard as a preacher, telling whoever will listen that life's not about big houses and achieving American dreams, but about God and real love stories. And I think it's fitting to share a story like theirs on a day like this, as Valentine cards empty from store shelves. I think it's fitting because one of Hallmark's prefab love lines may do the trick this Sunday for some, but any set of sweethearts serious about standing the test of time should look hard at Tony's twofold approach to marital longevity. Her plan was pretty simple. She believed in the practical demonstration of love, thus the notes, and she believed in God, thus the prayers. So maybe you're like me, thinking that's a good two-sided coin to carry around in your heart pocket, no matter what kind of Valentine's Day you're anticipating this year. On the other hand, maybe you're thinking, who's anticipating Valentine's Day? Because stories like those of Tony and her husband, well, they're just stories, right? Not happening in your world. Your marriage is hanging on by a thread, and a frayed one at that. Tony would say, be thankful for the thread. And right after that, she'd say, try tending your marriage. Try the twofold approach. I'm Kim Henderson.
Tomorrow, John Stone Street joins us for Culture Friday.
And I'll review a new movie about an extraordinary discovery that changed our understanding of medieval history. That and more tomorrow. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Proverbs tells us that whoever covers an offense seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates close friends. I hope your day goes well, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.